What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd. My co-host is Thomas Strantz. Strantzer, of course, covers the team for The Athletic as well. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Drantz, what's going on, man?
Not much, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing great. I realized or learned for the first time, or maybe remembered, that we don't have a show tomorrow because there's a Nooner at the Nat on the air. So that's very exciting. Long weekend for us. I'm in Friday vibes mode already. I'm feeling great.
Cool. I booked my flight so that I would be able to do the show. So love to know that.
Well, that's nice.
Classic Canucks talk. Always, always have our P's and Q's.
We've already ready to got, go. We've always got things absolutely tied down.
Hey, is that an I that needs dotting? A T that needs
that's
crossing?
Fine. Who cares?
Trust us at Canucks Talk to take care of it.
Well, I'll be having a great day in the sunshine, and best of luck to you with your travel plans tomorrow.
Sounds like a blast, buddy.
Josh and I will be at the Nat,
wish though. I was there.
That's true, yeah. I should mention that. From 11 to 1, Canucks Brunch with Josh and Lena will be taking over and leading you into the Nooner at the Nat on the airwaves tomorrow. We do have a big show coming up today, 12:30. Really looking forward to this. Derek Lalonde is going to join the program. Of course, former NHL coach, doing some fantastic work on the Hockey Night in Canada panels during these Stanley Cup playoffs, so no shortage of things to get into with Derek.
We'll see if I can get him to crush Jim Hiller.
Good luck.
It's been a very Willie Desjardins-like coaching performance from Hiller,
yeah,
which is too bad.
But yeah, we'll talk Stanley Cup playoffs and, I mean, the coaching market from a recent NHL coach's perspective as well with Derek Lalonde, and then Jesse Granger from The Athletic covering the Golden Knights and just the playoffs in general with Jesse at 1 o'clock as well. So Derek Lalonde, 12:30, Jesse Granger at 1, but right now let's go to the whiteboard.
All right, now, fellas, hey, let's focus up, huh?
It is your daily deep dive into what's up with the Canucks and the NHL for today, May 1st. And we'll start with the headlines. And, I mean, the last couple of days, Drantz, we really have not had much time to dig into what's been happening around the league because, for obvious reasons, we have been so preoccupied with the Canucks and the Rick Tocchet story, the head coaching vacancy and all of that. But, you know, we are starting to get to the end stages of round one here. Two more teams advance yesterday. Florida and Washington advance in the East. Winnipeg goes up 3-2 with a 5-3 win against St. Louis in that series. And tonight, four teams have a chance to book their spot in the second round. Four game sixes on the schedule tonight. Battle of Ontario, Leafs and Sens, Golden Knights in the Wild, Stars and Avalanche, and the Oilers and the Kings. So I don't know if there's anything you want to hit from last night, but we can start there or we can focus in on tonight. What's caught your attention or are you looking forward to going into this slate of games tonight?
Well, the Florida Panthers are clearly the highest gear team in the NHL.
Yeah.
And I think they, quite understandably, given their recent track record of success, I mean, this is a team that's been to, what, the last two cup finals, winning last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think this season meant as much to them as it meant to some of the other teams in their division. For example, a Toronto Maple Leafs core group that had never won the division in the Matthews era. And maybe that lulled everybody, including me, I had the Lightning in seven, into a false sense of, you know, forgetting exactly what this Panthers sort of top-end scenario looks like because I don't know. I think the league's on notice. They're the best team in the league.
Yep.
I mean, I don't think it's an overreaction. Here's the stat. Braden Point versus Sasha Barkov head-to-head in this series.
Mm-hmm.
Plus one for Tampa Bay. Cirelli, who was banged up in game one and didn't quite look like himself the rest of the series, head-to-head against Sam Bennett, plus two for Florida. So top six, at least in the head-to-head matchup that we saw most commonly, a plus one differential in Florida's favor. They won in five. How? Itu Lusteranen and Anton
Lundell.
Oh my God! Why I want to call him
Anton
sorry?
Lundell. Anton Lundell.
I want to call him Anton Forsland for some reason. It just like my brain completely broke there. And the newcomer on that line, do the pantomime like hiss, boo, Brad Marchand, completely picked their teeth with the Lightning. And last night in particular, I mean, the work from Lusteranen, both of the goals that Florida scored to take that lead came directly off of Lusteranen, who has emerged as maybe the best defensive winger in this game, aside from his teammate, Sam Reinhart. Must be nice. Effectively eating Kucherov's lunch. You know, Kucherov tried to dance him once on the power play, sort of up high, once sort of at the Bowman line, trying to poke a puck through his skates, nutmeg him. Those skates closed quick, and Lundell got the puck moving the other direction. I mean, as good a two-way performance as you'll see, it was like 6-2 in those minutes. That third line just ran roughshod over the Tampa Bay Lightning, and now we come out of that series just thinking, oh boy, like, you know, the Maple Leafs have won 3 of 5 coin flips against the Senators, and the Panthers just absolutely demolished a Lightning team that I think we rightly assessed as being one of the NHL's 5 best teams going into this playoffs, and they weren't even in it.
And you start to look at the path ahead for the Panthers, right? And as you said, Leafs are Senators, right? And it's not like the Leafs have exactly covered themselves in glory here. We can talk more about that some point.
It's the Leafs, man.
Yeah, it's the Leafs. Like, but then I would say on the other side of the bracket in the East. On the other side of the bracket in the East, like Washington, I don't want to say it's identical to the discussion last year about the Canucks, right? Like Washington's a good team, but not as good as their regular season record indicated, right? And Carolina, I think we also rightly have concerns about them going up against a top end team deep into the playoffs, right? And whether that's something that they're up for. So you start to look at it and look, it's not easy. Going to the Stanley Cup 3 years in a row is phenomenally difficult. That's a lot of extra miles. I mean, how many guys did they have at the Four Nations this year, right? A lot, because they're a really good team who played some extra intense games there as well. So it's going to still be a grind and a big deal for them. But, like, the pathway is there. And especially wrapping up this series quickly, what a bonus for them. As you say, we all expect, and we'll see what happens, but we all expect there to be a Game 7 for the Leafs and the Senators at some point. Like, a huge way to start the proceedings for Florida. And now you look at it, and the bracket seems to be just setting up incredibly nicely for them to make another run.
Yeah, they look scary. That was a declaration of intent from my alma mater. So I enjoyed that last night. Habs, I thought they accounted for themselves well. You know, I actually think the Habs story, the interesting Habs story for me anyway, and I'm sure our audience or our longtime listeners will be shocked to hear this, is, you know, there's a downside to being ahead of schedule.
Sure.
Right? In that you're no longer getting a shot to pick at the top of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And while Demidov looks sensational, you know, Reinbacher over Michkov, Slavkovsky over Cooley, I mean, those are things that I think we can look at as being, you know, maybe a little bit LA Kings-ish, you know, where, hey, this team did a marvelous job rebuilding, as good as you can do. But if you don't get 90th percentile outcomes at the top of the draft, you know, that still can put a cap on you.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in a pretty delicate phase of their sort of team building cycle, having arrived ahead of schedule and then, you know, having seen their best players perform so well against this measuring stick Capitals team. Obviously, they lost mostly because Suzuki against Dubois was a matchup that favored Washington, not heavily, but the truth is that the Habs don't have that like secondary offensive push, and so when Dubois was able to swallow up Suzuki, they didn't have that second line center, that third line center that could create the environment they needed to manufacture enough offense. 7 5-on-5 goals across that 5-game series. So that's the story there. The Habs impressed, but I almost worry that they've arrived too far ahead of schedule and maybe not mined enough high-end talent, right, from their downturn seasons, which I just worry. Does that leave you as being like Kings East?
Mm.
if they're not very, very careful about where their next sort of step falls.
Yeah, well, there's also the question of kind of perception in that market, right? Like, you've taken that jump forward now and made the playoffs. How much of an appetite is there to go backwards, right? Like, if you're the 10th seed in the East next year, right, the 10th team, it's like that's going to be viewed as a massive disappointment, and that starts to ratchet the pressure up. And how does that influence what management wants to do and all of those things in their next in the next phase of their build?
Yeah, and it's very possible. I mean,
yeah, of course,
there's a lot of non-playoff teams in the East. You know, everyone from Philadelphia to Columbus to the New York Rangers, that, you know, to the Pittsburgh Penguins, that I don't think will be stunned, you know, if they're playing in a first round series a year from now, right? Like, it's a very competitive conference. There are no teams that are pushovers, basically, except unless Boston sort of enters a more protracted inhalation period. Are we going to get to the Nick Kipper call?
Yeah. So I want to, we'll go to the broadsheet here. Now, there's some coaching stuff as well, but you want to start with the tidbit that took Twitter by storm here from Nick Kipprios earlier today?
However you want to do it.
All right. So Nick Kipprios, in his column at the Toronto Star, you know, largely focused on other things around the NHL, but included this information relevant to the Vancouver Canucks. I'll read it verbatim here from Nick Kipprios, who, of course, hosts Kipper and Bourne on the Fan 590 in Toronto. One question starting to circulate out of Vancouver is whether or not the Aquilini family is contemplating selling part or the majority of the Canucks. There's speculation that Luigi Aquilini, the founder of Aquilini Investment Group, and his two sons, Paolo and Roberto, who have no active roles in the hockey club, may have grown a tad tired of the constant drama surrounding the team. The Canucks are run by Luigi's eldest son, Francesco, who's the chairman and governor. Market value for the hockey club in Rogers Arena is speculated to be between $2 to $3 billion. So the meat there. And I think it's important to note, as always, with reports like this in the insider world, what is the actual language? And the actual language is there's speculation that they may have grown a tad tired of the constant drama surrounding the team. One question starting to circulate out of Vancouver is whether or not the Aquilini family is contemplating selling part or the majority of the Canucks. Now, our colleague Satyar Shah put out on Twitter not that long ago that says he talked to sources with the Canucks and the team is not for sale. Of course, that's not what Kipprios said exactly, right? He didn't say the Canucks are for sale. He didn't say the Aquilini group is going to sell the team. He said the question is coming out about whether or not they are contemplating selling it. So still significant. I don't want to downplay that it's a significant, because, you know, these kinds of things, people text in about it or you hear about it in whispers or whatever, right? But for someone like Nick Kipprios to put his name on this and write it down out there for everyone to see is still significant, but it is the kind of situation where you really have to parse like exactly what he's saying and what's being reported.
Very significant. And I'll add this. I mean, you know, I take it additionally seriously because some of those whispers from people who would know reached me yesterday afternoon. I was busy. I didn't like run it down because also these come across, like these come across my, you know, my phone wire. I don't know. What is it? Like, it's not across my desk. I'm not sitting down.
Yeah. They come across your phone. That's close enough.
Yeah. They come across my smartphone screen every now and then. And yeah, another one came across for me yesterday afternoon. And so I certainly perked up when I read Kipprios's report. And you know, I suspect that Satyar Shah, I don't suspect, I know that Satyar Shah's information here is bulletproof. And so I think the way that I'd love to caption this, Jamie, if you'll bear with me and if we have time, is to just work through like how I think about this stuff.
Okay.
And how I think fans should think about this stuff. And why, to be totally honest with you, when I heard the latest gossip, I found it interesting but not urgent. Right.
Well, I mean, I'll step in just before you get going. It's not phrased in an urgent way. You know what I mean? So that's number one. It's like, oh, that's interesting. But it's not like we're going to hear news next week or anything like that.
Yeah. Or that there's like been a third party brokerage sort of firm hired, or, you know, more sort of involved sorts of processes begun to be put in place to facilitate, you know, a $2 to $3 billion sale. My goodness. Now, the Canucks obviously were bought for an estimated $250 million. The exact total was never made fully public, despite, you know, the blow-by-blow of how the purchase went down being public record. as a result of the BC Supreme Court case mm-hmm. challenging the purchase, you know, between Gilardi and Ryan Biddy and the Aquilini family back in, what, 08 or 07. Good reading. If you're interested, you can check that out, you know, on the BC Supreme Court website. And that purchase, so look, that asset is appreciated massively. And I think the way that we should think about this sort of thing and these sorts of stories is to understand that even if there is like a controlling group, the Aquilini sort of sports and entertainment group under the Aquilini Investment Group, which, you know, has an awful lot of different development,
yep.
real estate, wine,
restaurants,
farms, yep. restaurants. Yep. The Canucks do their own F&B in-house. I mean, it's a complicated business empire, you know, and I think the way to think about this is from the perspective of family business, an asset that is purchased and appreciates 10 times over the course of 20 years is complicated to value within the context of things like inheritance or changing family dynamics. And I've always thought that if this team was ever sold or put up for sale, it would be sort of that basic difficulty in like maintaining familial fairness mm-hmm. when you've got an asset that's you know, monetized in this way or appreciated in this way.
So let's translate.
That would sort of create that pressure. Let's
translate what you're saying into terms that a lot of people here in Metro Vancouver can understand, right? Your parents are getting older. They have a house that they bought in the 70s or 80s that is worth massively more. You have two brothers and sisters, so it's three kids. And it's like, well, one of them, maybe we could give the house to this one. And it's like, well, hold on now. That's a $2.5 million house. Are they going to buy us out? And then it's easy. You're just like, you know what, we're gonna sell the house and you guys split the money, right? Rather than trying to figure out who gets the house, because you can't, only one person can live in the house, only one family can live in the house. It's easier just to monetize it, have the cash, and divide that.
And so for that reason, when these rumors come across my desk anyway, I tend to think not now or not yet, or that doesn't make sense to me unless there's, you know, some sort of family dynamic change that we're not aware of. And that's sort of the way that I think about this. Now, to zoom out to some of the dissatisfaction that we're seeing in this market over the course of this week, right? One thing about the Canucks and one thing about sort of the way that this all interacts, the Aquilini ownership with like the Vancouver economy, with global economic trends, that nexus that sort of determines rational decisions made by massive business leaders in our community, right? Is for a family that's obviously earned their wealth in development, having a major attraction, right? That their business is uniquely well positioned to benefit from in terms of monetizing, right? And that means whether it's the apartment buildings that have been built around it or development in downtown Vancouver or the restaurant scene in downtown Vancouver, right? Like there's an awful lot of synergies, I suppose, between the Canucks being a major attraction in this city and the real estate business and the entertainment business in downtown Vancouver. And, you know, for that reason, I think you have an incentive, right, to make sure that that team is always of interest, right, is always selling at least hope, if not meaningful championship ambitions in this city. And given sort of the short-term priorities that we've seen this organization often prioritize, I think that makes a ton of sense. Like, we live in a city where, you know, the total appraised value of real estate holdings is like larger than Chicago, despite the gap in GDP between our two metropolitan areas. And, you know, within that context, I'm often skeptical when these reports come out, at least initially, in part because just the way that their business is set up and the value of the Canucks from the perspective of a developer or restaurant owner or what have you is like so obviously interrelated. And I actually do think it crosses over and helps explain, at least to some extent, why this organization has sort of stubbornly focused on being like an annual playoff team, as opposed to doing what, on this program anyway, you and I, with no skin in the game, might describe as like being reluctant to do the long-term work required to build a Stanley Cup team, which is not to say that that is not also an ambition of the family. I'm certain it is. But I do think the business realities of like how the Canucks fit within the constellation of those business holdings is like worth unpacking and thinking about, if only to help our audience like better interpret this information the next time we bump into something like this. You know, whether that's this story turns out to be a developing one over the course of the next 6 months, or whether or not there's 3 years that pass before there's more whispers like this that surface, you know, in a credible insider report from outside the market.
All right. So there's a lot there. And I do think it's maybe worth getting back into a little bit later on in the show as well. Like some of the reasons that to be skeptical of it, some of the reasons why maybe things could be changing on that front as well. Again, we're building off a report here from Nick Kiprios, or at least a report's probably too strong a word, but Nick Kiprios mentioning he's hearing this speculation that they could be contemplating selling the team. Again, Satyar Shah saying, as of right now, the team is not for sale. So we can dig into that more later on in the show. Before we take a break here, we've got Derek Lalonde on the other side. I want to do one to watch brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. And I went to this the other day, right? And I said Linus Allmark, and he had a pretty good performance in the game the Ottawa Senators won. Now all of the focus is on the Toronto Maple Leafs, and yes, the core four. As much as Craig Berube is saying, "Well, no, it's a team game. We need everyone, not just the core four." The spotlight's on those guys, and I think more than maybe it ever has been before, specifically on Auston Matthews. Questions about Auston Matthews and whether he is going to show up and have a superstar-type performance for this team in Ottawa in Game 6. So my one to watch, Auston Matthews tonight for the Leafs in a game that, man, if they lose, woo, the drama and the pathos in Toronto for Game 7 is going to be phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Leafs have one of those profiles where you should never be shocked when a team that generates offense at the clip that they do in terms of the looks that they actually create spends 120 minutes scoring a goal, manufacturing 50 shots. Like, that's always been in their range of outcomes based on their evolution as a team.
Yeah,
sound familiar, Jamie? So I won't be surprised at all. You know, these two teams play a one-goal game decided by a puck that bounces off a skate, just like every other game we've seen this series.
All right, that's one to watch brought to you by Delaney's.
My antipathy for this series, by the way. It's such miserable hockey.
I'm just in it for the Leafs collapse. That's what I'm here for. I don't care how it happens or how it looks aesthetically. That's what I'm here for. One to watch brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. It's time to put on your Toyo tires. Whether you drive a car, light truck, or van, Toyo tires are designed to perform in all kinds of conditions. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Aldergrove. We'll take a break. Derek Lalonde, former NHL head coach, now doing great work on Hockey Night in Canada, joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. And now joining us, very pleased to have on the show, former NHL head coach, and now, as I said, doing fantastic work on the Hockey Night in Canada panels during these playoffs. He is Derek Lalonde. Derek, thanks very much for doing this today. How are you?
I'm good, guys. Thanks for having me. You guys... I kind of made a commitment in this first round. If anybody, whatever you need from me, Sportsnet, but all these East teams want me at 8 in the morning. And I'm like, no way. When you guys called, I'm like, yep, available. Sign me up. 3:30? Yes, I'm there.
Absolutely. Look, a man after my own heart, Derek. I wouldn't want to be getting that wake-up call either. So we appreciate it. Thank you for making the time. It's awesome to have you on. And we'll dive into the playoffs here in a second. But, you know, obviously the coaching carousel and the coaching market very much front of mind here in Vancouver with the departure of Rick Tocchet. And one major trend, and, you know, you're well aware of this in the NHL now, is just how short coaching tenures have gotten. And Tocchet, the situation there is a little different because he voluntarily stepped away. But, I mean, I think before he left, he was like the eighth longest tenured in the league. Just from your perspective as someone who's obviously spent a long time as an assistant, had the head coach role as well, what's your perspective on the shape of the NHL coaching market these days?
It's interesting. I believe when I got fired, I was told I was tied with Marty St. Louis as the sixth longest tenured coach. So that puts a lot of things in perspective. Obviously, I was entering my third year. For me, just kind of the way I look at everything, I just look at it as a reality. It's what it is. You can sit here. I know some coaches get upset. I've had some of my peers upset with the landscape of it. But for me, it's just a simple reality. And, you know, maybe why this is my first time going through it. And, you know, some of my peers, I used to, like, Pete DeBoer laughed at me. He's like, I've been fired six times. Lou Lamoriello fired me on Christmas Eve. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. And he's like, it's the reality of it. It's anything with our profession. It's like when you hear noise, you know, even in Detroit, you know, I'm coming off winning two Stanley Cups. I get my first head coaching job. We improve, you know, 17 points over 2 years. I took a team that was projected to be in the low 80s to 91 points in a virtual tie with the Washington Capitals, ironically. They win the tiebreaker. And I think I'm going to get, like, a parade in the media in the summer. And now I'm getting all these, Lalonde's not good enough. He blew it. It's so easy today to point the finger and just it's part of the social media landscape. Didn't bother me. It's just noise. To me, it's a reality of it. It's like any good player or coach. You just focus at the task at hand. So, again, it's certainly not ideal. It's absolutely crazy. But, again, it's a reality. And us coaches have got to have tough skin.
And one of the other byproducts of that, of course, of lots of coaching turnover, is there's lots of open jobs at the moment. I believe 8 openings around the NHL right now. You never know. That could increase after the first round of the playoffs wraps up as well. But it's always such an interesting dynamic trying to determine, you know, which jobs are the most attractive, because you'll often hear it's 1 of 32, right? So, hey, there's always going to be interest and demand for these jobs because they're so hard to come by. But looking beyond that a little bit, and, you know, obviously besides the number one factor of a team having a really good roster if it happens to have a job opening, from a coach's perspective, what makes an opportunity more attractive or more appealing for a coach to be willing to go there and take on the head coaching role?
Well, the easy answer is a goalie and a lot of talent. I mean, that's an obvious. You look at the roster, of course. Like, and I certainly understood coming in as an assistant coach, never having had coaching experience. I was not going to have the opportunity like the Mike Sullivans or even what you've seen with Rick Tocchet now, where, you know, they're kind of at the top of the pecking order and kind of choose where they're going to go. So Detroit was exactly a perfect scenario for me. I know it was a roster in transition. Obviously, they've had some issues, you know, just not getting very lucky and where they draft and so on. But it's experience and it's growth, and it was unbelievable. But for me, the number one thing is relationships. Relationships for who I'm working with, the manager, obviously the coaching staff, but the players. I've always been a relationship type guy. It's probably how I got to the top of the profession. I say all the time, I kind of backed into the top of the profession coming from the college ranks, where you're recruiting these young kids. It's just a different relationship. I'm sitting there telling a 15-year-old and his parents, I'm going to take care of them. You have those kids 365 days a year. Some of my best relationships are guys I coached in college. And I came to pro hockey relationship based, and it's helped. And today's NHL, you have to have accountability, but likability. You can see that obviously that hard bully type of coach is just simply not going to make it in today's day and age. So I've had that balance. Relationship important to me. I've always been that guy, and it's been successful. So I just think that's where it's trending. And that's reality. So look, I guess the answer in short, it's relationships at every level, from the equipment manager to the security guy walking the door to see every day to obviously managers.
So, Derek, I don't know if they gave you a proper pre-scout on just how odd our show is, but we have a lot of theories.
No,
and when we get a chance to and when we get a chance to test them with someone who's been practically focused on winning games at this level, we have to do so. You talked about relationships there, and one thing we've seen over the course of the past couple of years is that a generation of like goalies winning the battle against shooters has kind of receded over the past couple of years as save percentage has dropped in the league. And I think the theory is that what that creates is an environment where, Connor McDavid, for example, can go absolutely nuclear the way he did in the playoffs last year and have almost an unusual impact relative to how the game was played a decade ago in terms of determining outcomes. First of all, do you think that theory is fair? And secondly, does it increase the importance of having an active partnership, whether you're the head coach or an organization, with a star-level player in particular?
Well, two-level question. First of all, I'll start it with the scouting report I got from Lena was simply, hey, they're great guys. That's all I got. So that was all.
She fooled you.
You talked about managing up. Your producer has your back. There's 100% on that. First of all, goals. Goals getting scored. I think the skill level of the players is next level. Been part of the U.S. system forever and spent the last couple of years working with David Carl in the summer with his national development or the World Junior team. So I've got to see these age groups. I got to let go from Detroit. I spent once a week with the U18 team, who's now at World Championships. Some unbelievable experiences for my own personal growth, but every single year, just seeing that pool of guys, the skill set is just through the roof right now. So one, I think that's why you're scoring goals. Two, I think you're coaching to score goals. There's a ton of coaching that goes into it. There's offensive structure, there's transition, there's being on top of the goalie. As I talk about even my segment in the middle of the game last night, I just come on from the earlier game. I get on and, first two goals are just guys at the net taking the goalie's eyes, playing bad goalies. So I just think there's a really emphasis on producing goals because you need goals to win. And then last, of course, you need the relationship with your top players. That's the reality of it. I felt very fortunate. My relationship with Dylan Larkin grew immensely. I felt I grew him as a leader and a captain, but the reality was we weren't going to go anywhere if you didn't have that relationship with Dylan Larkin or Lucas Raymond. I saw our coaching staff grow with Nikita Kucherov, who I think is the best player in the world right now, and I watched him go from a little resistance with some coaching staff, and we're sitting here like, God, I don't know if we can ever win this guy, too. It's the exact reason why we won. Was that type of guy. So 100%, of course, that relationship. And that's why you see the coaching world right now. The guys that are having success at it, it's usually relationship-based. And I know talk a little bit, but I give him a lot of credit. My assistant coach, Jay Verity in Detroit, was his assistant coach. So I think I got a little bit with him. We crossed paths. But I think you guys would be surprised at how good of a communicator he is and how hard he worked on it on his second time as being a coach. I take, for example, Connor Garland. I had at World Championships, and I loved Connor. And Connor and I had a really good relationships. Obviously, I had Phil Hronek in Detroit, and Phil had a breakout season for me, and obviously, wanted the first and second round pick in a draft. But he dug in on those type of relationships. He would talk to Jay Verity. He would talk about how do I get to Philip Hronek, and it's not an accident. He sparked, and it went even this far. They came into town, and they're playing Detroit, and I'm walking home. They have a later practice. I'm just walking through the hallway, and there's Connor and we're talking, having a deep conversation, and it was deep. And, you know, Connor's like, hey, Newsy. And he's like, oh, I love talk like that. You can tell, like, you see him as a hard guy. Obviously he's demanding, he's accountable, but he did a really good job of relationships. To me, those are the modern coaches that are succeeding right now. And I think all the comments, some of the players said about him out the door, I think speak volumes of who he is. Again, that coach that can balance accountability and likability, and he's certainly doing it right now.
Derek, you spent a lot of time around Cooper and the Tampa Bay Lightning. You obviously were a big part of the Cup wins earlier this decade. Pretty disappointing showing against the Florida Panthers. But, you know, the Cirelli injury game one, I know he played through it, but it didn't look like it did during the regular season. Obviously, they don't have Bjorkstrand. You know, it sort of piled up on them. And then Florida's depth kind of overwhelmed them as the series went along. Given your unique perspective of that team, how did you see, you know, game five in that series generally, you know, knowing what you know about the inner workings and what that organization's trying to accomplish on the ice?
Yeah, great question. And you talk about relationships. It's funny. I still root for that team because it's personal. It's personal with relationships. Even when I got fired by Detroit, my wife joked, like, hey, you can start rooting for Detroit, or excuse me, start rooting for Tampa again. So I did see it firsthand. And again, I just think they ran into a wagon. And I'm not making excuses. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's three straight years since they've won a series. I think I was the last time they won a series when I was there, when we went to the Stanley Cup Finals. I haven't won a series since. So you see them keep that core together, and they're just a really good team. And this is not an excuse for them. I believe they're one of maybe three or four or five of the top teams that could literally win a Stanley Cup. They just ran into a wagon. I feel that comfortably. I committed to working the first round on Sportsnet here and for Hockey Night in Canada. And I got on JD's podcast. Again, you know, whatever Sportsnet needs from me, I would love to help out. And he just asked me to watch right down the stretch. Toronto played Florida. And if you recall, Florida was on like a five, six game losing streak. They were a shell of themselves, mm-hmm. but they started to get some pieces back. They got Barkov back. They had Marchand back. So I loved the fact I was going on next day, but it gave me a time to not just watch like I do everyone else. I'm watching six games a night, seven games. I'm watching this. I'm watching that. I watched that game. I treat it like a pre-scout. I did the pre-scout. I did strengths with analytics, and I watched it. And I got out of that game. I'm like, wow, Florida is a wagon, and they still had pieces not in the lineup. Their depth, their two-way centers, their depth on D, and then you throw the world-class goalie, how they execute on special teams. Again, not an excuse for Tampa. They ran into the wrong opponent. I believe they beat maybe 13, 14 other teams, but that's the reality of it. And I've never been you hear some noise of one versus eight going back to that approach. I've never been that. I just think the top team wins. It's always the top teams standing there. And man, the one year we won the Stanley Cup, we had to go the pandemic year. We had to go through Carolina and Philly, or excuse me, Carolina and Florida in the first two rounds. Arguably the two best teams in the league. They were record percentage wise. So it's always the best team always wins. But to watch Tampa go out 3 years in a row in the first team and twice to a wagon like that, I probably have some time now for maybe a 1-8 matchup. So. And I kind of got rambling on here, but more kudos to that Florida squad right now than to what Tampa didn't do.
In conversation with former NHL head coach Derek Lalonde, who's working for Sportsnet during the first round on the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast. And Derek, I just want to backtrack a little bit to something you mentioned about your time in Tampa Bay and with Nikita Kucherov specifically. And you talked about the relationships there between him and the coaching staff and kind of him going from obviously a phenomenally talented and productive player in the NHL, but maybe internally there's some questions. Okay, are we going to win with this guy? To, as you said, being the exact reason you win and now, you know, being one of the handful of the best players in the NHL up for the Hart Trophy again this year. That transition from questions about can we win this guy to being the reason we can win, what did you see change? What happened that put him from one category into the other in Tampa?
Well, I think one thing was we had a balance. We used to, literally, the conversations would just meet us in between. Like, we're going to let you create your offense. We're not going to take it away from you. I mean, he is the best playmaker, the things he does. And when you said, you know, one of the best players, in my opinion, this is no slight anyone else. Right now, he is the best player in the league, the way he's able to produce and how he does it and the creativity of his offense. But we didn't want to take that away, but just meet us in between with some of our winning habits, you know, managing situations, you know, not turning pucks over in certain situations, getting above uncertain, not cheating, you know, somewhere in between. And I think what he saw is he saw what winning started to look like. And I think he saw you could literally do both. And then now he gets a taste of that winning. And he just took off. And now he has the ability of just carrying the team by himself. We were luxury of having really good teams. He was a big part, catalyst in carrying us. But obviously, our depth in those teams was really special. But I think just that balance between still being who he is, the best offensive player in the world, but still having some winning habits to go along with that. And then you get rewarded with it. And then you have the player you have, or what you have right now, Nikita Kucherov.
And Derek, before we let you go, I mean, I got to ask about the Battle of Ontario on tap tonight, Game 6. And, you know, we all know the Maple Leafs' recent history in elimination games. It is not pretty, or at least I should say games where they have the ability to eliminate the other team. It's not pretty. And it's interesting because Craig Berube, obviously his first year there, so he's not a part of that history necessarily. He's coming in with a little bit of a blank slate to this situation. What do you think, what would your message be to the Leafs in this situation where you know they have that history and they're trying to overcome it tonight?
Yeah, great question. We're actually going to have my pregame. It's going to be a little bit of a segment on that. First and foremost, they're a really good team. They've done a really good job. We came in and played them in November, and they took a 2-1 lead in the third period, and they only had maybe two shots in that in the third, and they beat us 2-1 with only having probably six or seven shots in this game, and it looked comfortable. I thought they were changing their DNA, so I think they're well-equipped for this, the depth of their lineup. But you know, I think for me, you're looking at they'll have two days, and you're probably going to get three meetings in those. And in those three meetings, you probably want solutions, and they'll have solutions in their five-on-five play, some of their structure. You're going to talk about perspective, and some of the perspective is, hey, you're up 3-2 in a best of seven series against a really good team. We're still doing a lot of good things than they have. But then I think they're going to probably challenge them and ask, we need a little bit more. We need a little more to flip this tight game. And you could probably see those 3 points kind of done with special teams too, how the power play obviously was on fire, and it's been 0-for-7 the last two games, but it still has done some good things, producing some chances. So I don't think there's any panic in that group. I watched the Marner interview right after the game. I loved it, and I believed him with how calm and the demeanor is. So, again, I think they'll put things in perspective. They have a 3-2 lead in a very tough series with a chance to close it out tonight, but they just need a little bit more. And I think you're going to see that out of the group tonight.
Derek, this was awesome. I know you said you're committed to Sportsnet through the first round. I don't know, maybe we can squeeze out another chat with you at some point here, because I really enjoyed this. Thanks for making time to chat with us today.
You got it. Thanks, guys. And anytime, appreciate it.
Appreciate it. That is Derek Lalonde.
Thanks, Derek.
Former NHL head coach. And as he just said there, you will see him again on the broadcast tonight on Hockey Night in Canada on Sportsnet for the Battle of Ontario, among other games, Edmonton and LA as well. And a ton to dig into there. And we do have to take a break for Jesse Granger just a minute here. But I wasn't planning to ask him anything related to Elias Pettersson, but just when he threw in the tidbit there about Nikita Kucherov and that relationship in Tampa and the evolution from them internally questioning, can we win with this guy, to what then Nikita Kucherov again eventually became, hard not to see some parallels between that and the Elias Pettersson situation here with the Canucks. And I found it striking when I asked him about it, and he said, you know, hey, meet us halfway. We want you to get your offense. We don't want to completely take that away, but there's certain baseline things you have to do and not cheating. I mean, that almost could have been word for word something we heard from Rick Tocchet over the last couple of years on Elias Pettersson, like strikingly similar to the message we've heard to Pettersson from this organization.
Did I miss it? You have to move your feet?
No, that wasn't in there. That was the big difference. I don't know if Kucherov ever had that problem.
I mean, I'll take Pettersson has to rein it in. He's cheating too much for offense. I'll take that.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Right? I mean, I I worry because I think what we saw this past season and down the stretch last year and into the playoffs, I think was materially more concerning, right? It's the let's get the juice back.
Yeah.
And then we'll rein it in. Worry about, you know, winning habits. Yeah, exactly. Let's just get the juice back.
That would be nice. Anyways, that was Derek Lalonde setting up the playoffs and his perspective on the coaching market around the NHL as well.
Fascinating. Awesome conversation.
Really enjoyed that with Derek.
Don't overpromise on our being good guys, though. I don't want to underdeliver.
Don't make promises that we can't keep here. Another game on the schedule tonight. No, we appreciate it. It's nice that you have our back.
We do appreciate it.
Thank goodness you're the ambassador out there trying to get guests and not us. It's a much better arrangement this way. That's all I'll say. Another game on the schedule tonight. Vegas trying to eliminate the Minnesota Wild after pulling out a pretty remarkable victory in Game 5 in that series. So we'll talk to Jesse Granger about that, some of the other big stories around the Stanley Cup playoffs. That is next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, footwear and orthotics working together with you in step. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And now joining us to talk about the Stanley Cup playoffs. There's four games on tonight, four teams with a chance to advance to the second round. One of those teams is the Vegas Golden Knights. And Jesse Granger covers the Golden Knights for The Athletic. Also covers goalies across the NHL. So excited to chat about that. And Jesse joins us now. Jesse, thanks for doing this. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's our pleasure. So we'll start with Vegas and Minnesota. And I think a lot of people had this as maybe not an easy victory for Vegas, but a comfortable series victory going in for Vegas. And they're still here with a chance to advance in six games. But there's been some pretty impressive performances from Minnesota, and they've had them on the ropes, I think it's fair to say, over the course of the series as well. What's been kind of the major story of this series from your perspective?
Yeah, I think that I kind of agreed with everyone, like you mentioned, that it wouldn't be that difficult of a series for Vegas. But I think the fact that Minnesota struggled so much without Kaprizov and Eriksson Ek down the stretch kind of tricked us into thinking that this wasn't that good of a team. We forgot how good they were early in the year when they had those guys. And Eriksson Ek has been not as good, but Kaprizov and Boldy have just been absolutely brilliant in this series for Minnesota. And I think that that's really the difference, and that's why it's been so close. And to me, early in the series, especially the first three games when Minnesota took a 2-1 lead, it was all Kaprizov and Boldy. And meanwhile, the Golden Knights star players, Jack Eichel and Mark Stone, were very quiet, held pointless through the first three games. And lately, they've been coming along, and now the Golden Knights top players are starting to play better, and they've kind of taken control of this series, coinciding with that. So I thought that Bruce Cassidy moving William Karlsson up onto Jack Eichel's wing was a really bold move. Karlsson is a true centerman. He's been a centerman his whole life. I think 455 games with the Golden Knights, and he's played on the wing 10 times out of that. Wow. And none of that was under Bruce Cassidy. So a very bold move for Cassidy in the middle of a playoff series to just throw Karlsson onto the wing. But it has worked great because he and Eichel are their two best defensive centers. They're both really good skaters, and they've put them on a line together, and he's paired them, or he's matched them up with that Kaprizov Boldy line, and the results have been great. They've contained that line better than they had prior, and they've scored some goals themselves. They obviously scored a shorthanded goal the other night. It's really got Jack Eichel going in this series. And when Jack Eichel's at his best, this Golden Knights team is really, really tough to beat.
Yeah, it's a great point about Jack Eichel because, I mean, he had such a phenomenal regular season this year. And I think it caught a lot of people, myself included, by surprise when he was struggling early in this series. And, you know, part of that, I think, is just a testament to how dominant Kirill Kaprizov can be. And throw in Matt Boldy there as a guy who's really blossoming as well. But just for people who maybe weren't locked in on the Golden Knights, give us a sense of just how good and dominant Jack Eichel has been for this team this year.
Yeah, I mean, he's been awesome. I think he belongs on Hart ballots. He obviously wasn't one of the three finalists. He was injured at the end of the year. He didn't get to that 100-point mark, and I think that's what kept him out of that top three. But I think he should definitely be in the top five on a lot of ballots. Obviously, he breaks a career high for points. He broke the franchise record for points in a season for the Golden Knights. And more importantly, I thought he was the best defensive player on the team all year long. He's their number one penalty killer. He leads the team in, or forwards at least, in penalty killing minutes per game, which is impressive. He's the number one power play guy. Everything runs through him on the power play. He's their number one ice time at 5-on-5. He usually gets the toughest matchup going against the opposing team's top line. So this is a guy who does everything in all three zones. He really is the engine behind this Golden Knights team. It's been cool to watch, because when he came over from Buffalo, one of the biggest things was they said, well, he had to do too much in Buffalo. And that was part of the reason they hadn't won, and part of the reason he hadn't lived up to expectations was they were just asking too much of a young player to come in and be the franchise for them. And now that he's in Vegas, he's going to be able to kind of just be one of the guys, and he can blend in the locker room with Mark Stone and Jonathan Marchessault and William Karlsson and Alex Pietrangeli. He doesn't have to be everything. Well, he came in, he did that, he won the Stanley Cup, and now he's taken his game to another level. So now he's on a winning team, and once again, he is everything, and it's worked really well. He's such a great player for this team.
Jesse, let's pivot and talk goalies really quick. Thatcher Demko, it becomes extension eligible July 1. We all know he missed extended stretches three separate times due to a variety of injuries. One of which, the knee tear, reportedly a popliteus tear, virtually unprecedented, is obviously a source of some concern. There's been, you know, some sense of optimism both from the player and the organization about the possibility of doing an extension. How do you regard Demko coming out of this season and sort of the wide range of outcomes here, given his obvious skill contrasted with, you know, the recent injury history?
Yeah, I think you nailed it when you said wide range of outcomes. Because to me, that is the story of trying to sign Thatcher Demko at this point right now. Because to me, I can't think of a goalie with a lower low and a higher high in terms of what you could possibly get out of him. Because if he's healthy, he's one of the best goalies in the league. I still think, even having him barely played this season, and it feels like that Vezina finalist season from the year before, it feels like forever ago because of how the injuries and the uncertainty around it. But he is still, to me, one of the top five goalies in the league when he's healthy. His footwork is perfect, essentially. For a guy as big as he is, he skates incredibly well. His positioning's good. He has the athleticism you need to make those high danger saves in lateral plays across the net. He's the complete package. There really isn't a weakness in his game to me, other than the fact that you can't count on him to be there all year long. And it's not just how many injuries he's had. It's the type of injuries. It's the timing of the injuries. It just seems like every time the Canucks need him to be there and be at his best, he just hasn't been. And that's bad luck. There's nothing he can really do about that. But yeah, I think it's a huge risk to sign him to a long-term deal. There's no question about that. Now, the fact that it can go on LTIR, like, I cover the Vegas Golden Knights, I know all about this. That is a safety net in terms of, if you sign him to this big deal and it's a long-term injury that keeps him out, you're not stuck in there. You can put him on LTIR and work around it. So there are workarounds. But yes, it's a huge risk. I think that it could be a heck of a deal, because you're probably not going to have to pay him what he deserves in terms of just how talented he is. I think you're probably going to get a deal on that because of the injury. So if all of a sudden he's healthy, then it's going to be a phenomenal contract, and you've got one of the best goalies in the league. And I think Lankanen getting that deal really helps, because he's a great backup. He's one of the better backups in the NHL. I think he was a pretty good starter this year. You can really lean on him and not play Thatcher 60 games a year. I think it's a great scenario for Vancouver if they get both of those two, but there is risk, and he's shown over the last couple of years that maybe he won't be on the ice a whole lot. And if you do commit a lot of salary cap to that, it can burn you.
And I've long been a Connor Hellebuck defender, verging on apologist. You know, not that he needs too much defending. I mean, he's on a historic three-year run here. But his playoff performance obviously has left something to be desired. And it feels like in this series, that's remained a pretty big story. What are you seeing from the NHL's best goaltender?
Yeah, I'm right there with you, being a Connor Hellebuck defender. And man, is it getting harder by the day. you know what? It's weird. It's really weird. It's confusing. It's hard to explain. He's not playing well. I think the first couple games of the series, he gave up some goal. Like the numbers weren't good. But the eye test to me, I still thought he was playing well.
Yes.
I didn't put much blame on him for many of these goals. I think that the Blues were screening him incredibly well, very similarly to how Colorado was last year. We all remember how bad the stats were last year against Colorado. I thought that a lot of those shots he had no chance on because of so many screens in front. Now, that's part of the goalie's job to see around those screens. And I do think that because Hellebuck, he's very minimal in his movement. And I think that that's part of his like superpower. I think that's what makes him great is he doesn't move a lot. He plays deep in his net. And I think he has calm eyes. Like, and like, I don't know how to explain this other than his goalie coach, Adam Francilia, gave me a great metaphor for this. And it's like, if you're sitting in the front row of a movie theater, and there's a huge action scene going on, you have no idea what you're watching. Whereas if you're sitting in the back of the theater, it's much easier to follow and track everything. And I think because Connor Hellebuck doesn't move much, it makes it easy to track pucks for him. He's very calm. There's not a lot of jumbling around when the pucks are coming in. But I think that maybe the calmness and how he doesn't move a ton might hurt him when looking around screens in the playoffs. And obviously in the playoffs, there's more traffic to look through. There's more chaos in front of you. And I think that maybe because he's so calm, he's not fighting to see around screens quite as hard as he should. And I think that that might contribute to it. But then I think you early in the playoffs, he lets in a few goals that maybe he shouldn't. And there's a lot of screens and all of a sudden the numbers aren't good. And then you obviously he hears the narrative. He's human. He hears the narrative that he's not playing well again. And then I think he's lost some confidence. And now these last couple games, he's letting in goals that are very uncharacteristic for him. Like the goal last night, the Snuggerud goal. That's one of the most off angle. Like you don't see NHL goalies get off their angle that bad. And Connor Hellebuck.
Especially not him.
I mean, that dude, like, if there's one thing he's never, it's off his angle. Like, this is the guy who is always in position. He's so calculated. He reads plays so well. And so for him to make a mistake like that, it's like it was so drastic and it was so against his style of play and everything that we know about Connor Hellebuck. It's very odd. I can't really explain why he's playing so poorly right now. The only hope is that, I mean, like you said, he's on a 3-year tear. This guy is the best goalie of this generation in the regular season. He's about to win his third Vezina. He's going to join Brodeur, Waugh, and Hasek as the only guys to do that since it became a voting award. Like that's the Mount Rushmore of goalies, and he's going to be on there by the end of his career. If you're the Jets, if you can just outscore this, and he find like eventually you hope that he will figure it out and he will calm down in there and you will get the Hellebuck we all know in the playoffs. And if they can score enough to advance far enough until you get that, well then man, Winnipeg is going to be scary. Good luck beating that team if they get the regular season Hellebuck at any point here. But yeah, it's very hard to explain why he hasn't played up to his potential so far in these playoffs.
Are there things that the Jets can or should be doing differently or try to do differently to kind of insulate? And it sounds ridiculous. So you need to insulate Connor Hellebuck. As you said, he's a phenomenal goalie. He's about to win a third Vezina trophy. But I also feel like part of this discussion with Hellebuck every year is teams start to score against him a lot in the playoffs. And then, you know, we hear about, well, this is how they're breaking down Winnipeg, or this is how they're targeting and attacking Hellebuck's weaknesses, and that's why they're having success. But, you know, every team is trying to do that against every other team in the playoffs. It's not like that's unique to the opponents of the Winnipeg Jets. So is it just strictly a Hellebuck thing, or are there things the Jets can be doing differently to stymie what the other teams are trying to target in Hellebuck?
I do think that they can be better in terms of limiting the screens and the chaos in front. And I thought that they did last night. I thought that that game last night, there was a lot less traffic in front of him, and he saw a lot more shots. And I think that if they can keep doing that for a couple more games, maybe that's how he finds it. And like part of it is just a personnel thing. Like they've got some smaller defensemen. Like Logan Stanley is a monster back there, but Josh Morrissey's not the most physical defenseman. Dylan DeMello, Dylan Sandberg, Neil Pionk. These are like smaller, faster, more finesse is just kind of the style that I see those guys as. So maybe they aren't as equipped to move clear guys out of the front of the net as some other defensive groups are. But to me, that's the key, because it's all about getting Hellebuck's confidence back. And I think a goalie like him who reads the play as well as he does when he's seeing the puck, if you can keep those guys out of his eyes and let him see the plays develop, all of a sudden he starts making his reads again. He starts making some big saves. The confidence is there, and you can get him back to playing at his best. I just think the more he sees the puck, the easier he's able to read these plays, the better for him.
One of the other games tonight, Edmonton and LA. Edmonton looking to close that one out. And, of course, they made the goalie switch in this series, going from Stuart Skinner to Calvin Pickard. And it is kind of funny because, I mean, they've won the games with Pickard in net, but so much of the story is just about how much they dominated possession in that last game and dominated the shot clock and scoring chances and all of that. Is Pickard kind of locked in as their guy, or do you still see a possibility, depending on how far they go, that they could be flip-flopping between Skinner and Pickard more?
Yeah, I mean, I could definitely see them going back to Skinner at some point if Pickard has a couple bad games in a row, because you look at their records, and yeah, Skinner's 0-2 and Pickard's 3-0, but if you just look at their individual play, it hasn't been that drastic of a difference. I think the Oilers found their game with Pickard in net, and part of that is sometimes, especially when you've got an offense like the Oilers and you can come back the way they can, sometimes you just need a couple saves. Like, we don't need you to be great back there all night. Just there's going to be a couple saves throughout this game that we need you to make. And Pickard has absolutely made those. And Skinner wasn't. So that's the difference. But because it's only a couple saves difference, it can go away just like that. Just the same way they found it, it can go away. And because I think if you look at their body of work and their careers, I think it's fair to say Stuart Skinner is a more talented goalie than Calvin Pickard. He's not playing better than him right now. Calvin Pickard's playing better, and I think Pickard should be in the net as long as he's doing that. But at the same time, if he falters for a couple of games, I think the leash has got to be pretty short, and you can go back to Skinner. And they did this last year, and Skinner, like, I think some goalies, if you bench him in the playoffs, maybe you're worried to go back to him. Like, have we crushed this guy's confidence?
Right.
It's going to be just a wreck if we go back to him. Skinner showed last year that he rose to that occasion. When they went back to him, he played really well. So if Pickard were to struggle for a couple games in a row, I wouldn't hesitate to go back to Skinner at any point.
Jesse, really appreciate the time. Enjoy all the games on the schedule tonight. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me, guys.
That is Jesse Granger from The Athletic, covering the Vegas Golden Knights and goaltending as well across the league, and weighing in on maybe, I guess, the biggest individual player-related storyline of the first round, which is Connor Hellebuck coming off just another phenomenal season, consensus Vezina Trophy winner, nominated for the Hart Trophy as well this year, which is very difficult for a goalie to do. And again, not just...
He's the favorite to win it.
And just having a really tough series. Like, there's no other way around it. And I thought Jesse laid it out really well there, where... Okay, some of the goals aren't his fault early on, but then it snowballs, and then you're starting to see some very un-Hellebuck-like mistakes creep into his game.
You also saw the Jets defending like one of those teams that knows they can't count on the save.
Right.
I thought that was, like, very pronounced yesterday. And that's when you start to, you know, I think about things a little bit differently. Like, when... the team's body language, when they're selling out to take away everything, you know, like Vegas is a good example of this. Vegas is, you want to pass the puck around and take shots from the perimeter, be our guest.
Yeah.
And the Jets last night, anyway, I thought, was it last night or the night before?
It was last night.
Sorry, it all blends together. I'm just watching hockey all the time. The Jets, I thought, were playing like a team that just knew that any chance we surrender could end up in the back of our net. That's a tough way to live.
Yeah, it's not ideal, especially when you think your ultimate strength, your ultimate edge over other teams should be your goalie, should be the fact that you have the best goalie in the league. That's not where you want to be.
And the swagger that comes with that.
Yeah. 650.
You know what I mean? Like, that
was... absolutely. Yeah, that should be an edge for your team. It's like, yeah, we don't have to worry about it. I always thought that with Tampa. When Vasilevskiy was at the absolute peak in their Stanley Cup years, it was like they had so much swagger from that because they knew that even if you broke them down, you still had to beat this incredible clutch all-world goalie at the back end. And it was just such a psychological edge for them that was so daunting for other teams to have to deal with. And it's just never translated into that for the Winnipeg Jets and Connor Hellebuyck. As I was saying, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And I want to just dip back in because we spent so much time in the broadsheet portion of the whiteboard focusing on the report, potential sale of the team, early speculation from Nick Kypreos of the Vancouver Canucks. There is some coaching news around the NHL, though. Some of it directly related to the Canucks, some of it not so much. So we'll start with the unrelated stuff here. Vince Mercogliano covers the New York Rangers in New York, says no confirmation here, but things are getting close to Mike Sullivan being officially hired to be the next head coach of the New York Rangers. No surprise there. I think that's been widely speculated on that Sullivan would end up in New York coaching the Rangers. So starting to get closer to that point. Frank Saravalli, though, go ahead.
We going to get John Tortorella assistant coach on the New York
Mike
Rangers?
Sullivan?
I mean, he wanted to just like, if he wanted to take a breath, right? I mean,
yeah,
those guys are boys. Like, I could see it.
Interesting. That would be a fascinating, fascinating development and a fascinating combination there. And then I also wanted to mention, it sure would be. It'd be very entertaining. Frank Saravalli reporting that Adam Foote is in the mix for multiple head coaching vacancies, or at least getting interest for multiple head coaching vacancies, and will get interviews in this process. And that I don't think we've really heard that name come up or his name come up before for non-Canucks openings. And of course, we'll see if he becomes a candidate for the head job here in Vancouver. If he doesn't get a head coaching job, the expectation is that he'll probably follow Rick Tocchet to wherever Tocchet's next job is. But I thought it was notable that it's not just, maybe we'll promote Adam Foote here in Vancouver, that he is getting interest and probably will get interviews for some of the openings around the league as well.
Yeah, Adam Foote's name is out there. I mean, pivoting to the Tocchet news like in real time, right, on Tuesday, I was pretty quick to mention, like, don't rule him out.
Yep.
There's real buzz around Adam Foote, not just, you know, it, from the perspective of, like, if he stays in Vancouver, it's going to need to be something like that, but from the perspective of league-wide interest based on the performance of Vancouver's defense. And look, we've seen assistants with similar profiles get jobs in the past. Bob Bugner, when he got hired in Florida, a team I worked for at the time, his calling card was, you know, the work that he'd done on DeBoer's staff with the Sharks, the, you know, glow up of Brent Burns and the performance of some of the area, their younger D at the time, and Mark Edward Vlasic and on, right? I mean, that was for Vancouver and for Foote. You know, he's got the endorsement of Quinn Hughes, which matters.
Yep.
We've seen Quinn Hughes play his best hockey across the last 2 years under this coaching staff. And, you know, I think their teaching is a huge role in that. Quinn Hughes' dedication and the scientific approach that he's taken to maximizing his skill set is a big part of that, too. But, you know, it was hardly a tap-in that you'd play Philip Peronik and Quinn Hughes together on a pair, which this organization committed to pretty early, and that became the best pair, maybe up there with Taves and Makar. Maybe you could – either way, you're debating between those two, Harley and Heiskanen. I guess those three. That was put together underfoot. You saw Nikita Zadorov become this unrivaled playoff game-breaker. Tyler Myers has had two of the most dependable two-way seasons of his career. The team did a great job against McDavid in the Stanley Cup playoffs last year. You've seen players like Elias Pettersson, come in and do really well, right? Show their mettle. So there's been, you know, like Noah Juulsen played 80 games for this team across the last 2 years. And was he the answer? Probably not. But did they make it work? I would say they did. So, you know, I think there's a lot more interest in Foote around the league than maybe we would have anticipated when the season ended, given what I'm hearing and obviously given this Saravalli report.
Yeah, so that's the latest on Adam Foote. And just to close off some of the coaching news, Pierre LeBrun, your colleague at The Athletic, reporting that the Ducks have interviewed Jay Woodcroft. He also says he hears that the Ducks GM, Pat Verbeek, recently met with David Carl. Believe Anaheim has also made contact with Mike Sullivan. And he says, as reported by others, Joel Quenneville will soon get a second interview. He also says other names in the mix, wide search by the Ducks. So we're very much into that portion of the process here where not just interviews, but second interviews happening in some instances with teams. We'll see if there's a Mike Sullivan announcement before the end of the week, as there's some rumblings out of New York on that front. But things are starting to pick up and things are starting to accelerate. And I don't expect it will be too long before we start to hear candidate X, not just that he's on the short list for the Vancouver Canucks, but that there's been interviews. There's been an interviewing process. And by the way, you know what I realized? This is the third coaching change that we've covered on our show in the Canucks talk era, but it's the first coaching search we've covered, right? Because it's an instant switch from Green to Boudreaux, and then the Boudreaux to Tockett one was telegraphed, what, for like a month out? We knew it was going to happen at some point, at least 3 weeks out. So this is the first time that there's actually been a vacancy that has not been instantly filled, or the presumptive lock to fill the position as soon as it's been vacant.
Well, organizationally, the Canucks don't like to not win the press conference.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd say one of our most widely panned social media videos was the one we put out the day of locker room cleanout day. Wouldn't you say?
Which one?
People were mad.
Like this past
one?
Well,
just the, yeah, where it was like, hey, it's not a good sign that talking with management.
Yeah.
And it wasn't.
Yeah, it turned out it wasn't. So anyways, that's just...
It never is. Like, God.
That's just an interesting wrinkle. This is new for us, going through the process of like, oh, who's getting interviewed and second interviews and, oh, what about this and all of that. Anyway, so it's going to be fun, I think. I get there was a lot of concern about how it played out, but I'm looking on the bright side. It's going to be a fun new experience for us all to monitor this and cover it and see who ends up being the next head coach of the Vancouver Canucks. We can talk more about that. Listen, we got to look forward to something here, Drancer. All right.
Woo. Fun.
Maybe there'll be even like a better quote than Tockett.
Pretty tough.
Yeah, that would be pretty tough. Anyways, we'll take a break.
We need Tockett to land and the dust to settle. So we can have him on.
Yeah, that's a great point. That would be awesome. All right, we'll take a break here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in, your questions as well. More Canucks talk on the other side here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors. For over 50 years, visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. And send your text. As I get a phone call right in the middle of the segment there, send your text in because we have an open segment here to wrap up the show. So 650, 650 is the number for the Dunbar Lumber text line. And I wanted to mention here, Abbotsford Canucks get going in round two of the Calder Cup playoffs against the Coachella Valley Firebirds, of course, the Seattle Kraken affiliate in the AHL. First two games, it's a best of five series at this stage. First two games are down in California in Coachella. First one is tonight at 7. Brandon Assel will have the call on the station right here on Sportsnet 650. So big game one of the second round of the Calder Cup playoffs for the Abbotsford Canucks. And this question actually came in a little bit earlier from Raman. I hope I'm saying that right, Raman, who says, I have an important question. Is it better for a young player's development to have a long AHL playoff run or to have more time in the offseason to train? And I mean, I think if you listen to the principals in the organization and what they have to say, clearly there is a lot of value put on the potential for a long Calder Cup playoff run and what that could mean and the opportunity that could afford to their young players and to Manny Malhotra as well, I'll say, as a first-time AHL head coach, but especially for their young players with the Abbotsford Canucks.
Yeah, I think there's not much question in my mind anyway. You know, you think about all the different players we've seen destroy it in the Calder Cup playoffs and sort of what they've gone on to do. You know, I think that captures sort of what we're talking about quite nicely. You know, the Washington Capitals, for example, right, were the team whose minor league affiliate won last year. And while guys like Hendrix LaPierre and Ethan Frank and Ivan Miroshenko, who starred for them in that sort of Calder Cup playoff run, weren't necessarily like the drivers of the success that that team this season, you know, Ethan Frank played like really good minutes for them and they benefited certainly from that experience. You know, the year before they also won it with like Beck Malenstein playing a huge role who they were able to monetize and Connor McMichael having 10 points in 20 games and Alexi Protas being one of their leading scorers. And we know what Protas did over the course of this year. And you go through sort of the recent history of Calder Cup winners and you'll find a ton of examples exactly like that, right? It was the Carolina Hurricanes affiliate in Chicago that won it a couple of years ago with guys like Jack Drury and Stefan Nason and Jalen Chatfield, right, who have gone on to do big things in the NHL. You remember the Toffoli, Lyndon Vay, Tanner Pearson line?
Sure do.
Right? That basically traded up. Sorry, Lyndon Vay, we're going to play between Jeff Carter now.
Yeah.
Or we're going to have Toffoli and Pearson play around Jeff Carter now.
I was a big Lyndon Vay believer.
Canucks might have picked wrong.
I was a big Lyndon Vay believer, I got to be honest with you. Before he got to Vancouver.
It was a worthwhile bet. Of the age gap trades, that was the one that I think made the most sense. So anyway, yeah, the truth is I do believe that Calder Cup playoff success matters, and I think it matters a ton, to be totally honest with you.
Yeah, I think it's just a fantastic opportunity, right? Like, and again, you don't have to take our word for it. When you talk to whether it's Ryan Johnson or Manny Malhotra, they're pretty upfront about what the opportunity represents and kind of what they're hopeful and the players can learn and take from it. And just, you know, it's just an opportunity to get pro level reps in for a lot of these players as well. And that's so, so crucial to taking those next steps is having a chance to develop in real intense situations against other players who are competing as hard as they can. You can try to simulate those circumstances in training in the off season, but it's really hard to do. And so I think reps like this are invaluable for young players. And hopefully, it's a long run for the Abbotsford Canucks in the Calder Cup playoffs. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And Mike, the urologist from Brockville, texts in, I haven't been able to listen to the radio all day. What happened? Did the Canucks get sold or what? And of course, that's in reference to the tidbit from Nick Kypreos in the Toronto Star today that there's speculation that the Aquilini Group is contemplating selling the Vancouver Canucks or that they might contemplate selling it. Vague, but raising the notion that the team could be sold. And as I mentioned, Satyar Shah reporting that the team is not currently for sale per his sources with the Canucks. And, you know, we walked through that at some length and got your perspective certainly on it in the first segment of the show, Drancer, and just kind of the way you look at the incentives for the Aquilini Group, how it relates to their other businesses and all of that. And I do think like that's all what you laid out there makes a lot of sense, right? Why it's a unique opportunity for them to own the Vancouver Canucks, given their other business interests, given the way they all interact, and why that always kind of makes us skeptical of reports that, oh, hey, could they sell the team? It's like, well, probably not, because there's all these reasons why they wouldn't want to. I do wonder. And like we've talked so much about the practice facility, right? And Kevin Woodley was on Canucks Central yesterday, and he said, look, there's been opportunities, but there's just not a willingness to pay. There's not a willingness to invest the money to build a practice facility. We look at the age of Rogers Arena, and yeah, there's been a fair amount of yes. renovation done to it, but you would have to think there's a lot more on tap in the years to come to maintain that building.
I mean, Rogers Arena is nearing the end of its functional life.
Yes.
And so I don't even know if you're able to do the scale of renovations to keep up with the sorts of revenue generating spaces that other arenas are able to construct effectively if you're building something new. And I don't know what the logistics of, you know, detonating it would be, given its proximity to the viaduct,
condos,
mention the condos that have newly gone up, like basically on the footprint.
Yep. Yeah.
There are some challenges are going to mount.
Yeah.
Here.
Like big decisions on the building, right? Do you build new?
Expensive decisions.
Do you move to the Coliseum for a year while you do a gutting and renovate? Like, what are the options there? Those are, as you said, massive, expensive decisions that involve a lot of money going into it. And then also there's the rising cap, right? There's the rising cap that's due to spike sharply here, assuming there's no catastrophes in the global economy, which, you know, big assumption these days. But it's due to go up a lot. Heck, even something like the coaching market, right? Like Mike Sullivan could be about to reset the coaching market here and push those salaries up around the league as well. So you do look at it, and there's a lot of general league-wide things that could make the yearly outlay of revenue or like operating expenses more expensive for an NHL team. And then there's Canucks specific things as well. And to tie it back into my Vancouver real estate metaphor from earlier, right? Where it's, hey, it's a family asset, but there's three kids and only one can live in the house. So why don't we just sell it and we'll split the money and we'll all do our own things with it. You know, another situation that comes up a lot is somebody's been in a house for a long time and the value has gone up a lot. And maybe the property taxes are getting to be a little much and the maintenance is getting to be a little much. And it's, you know what, rather than being asset rich and cash poor, why don't I monetize this asset and I'll downsize and I'll move into a condo. And hey, I can take a nice trip to Europe with the money I have left over anyways. And it'll make a lot more sense for me. And I do wonder, as expenses rise and as, you know, like, what's the sense of putting the new roof on the house if you're going to sell it in 5 years anyway, right? You may as well just sell it. Like, I wonder how much that starts to become a calculation with the league-wide stuff and then the Canucks-specific stuff with the building and the practice facility as well.
A lot of big ticket items loom on the horizon, without question. And I mean, the lack of progress on a practice facility, which the team's been talking about for literally 15 years with virtually zero progress. And in fact, you know, agreements that have been made with the Plaza of Nations redevelopment group that fell through and on and on. I mean, it's been a saga, and mostly a saga of entropy, like a saga in which nothing has occurred. You know, one of those sagas where people just sit around waiting for Godot. You know, that's really what we're doing. We're sitting around talking about a practice arena that will never break ground. So, yeah, I mean, look, this team has, as we've talked about, dark clouds gathering on the horizon. And some of them are going to require a level of investment that is massive, just massive. No question about it. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting subject to think through.
Yeah,
and I'm not
there's no
by
answer.
Any means pouring.
There's no answer. It's just a potential counterweight to the kind of unique considerations you laid out for keeping the team.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like you're right. Could you also construct the argument the other way, or could it go that way in the coming years? And again, I don't know the answer. I'm not privy to their thinking, but there's at least factors that you could see pointing in that direction.
Yeah, although again, I remain somewhat skeptical of sort of the idea of that being, you know, an active thing that we're really covering and talking about and reporting out over the next 6 months to a year. Which is not to say that I have a great sense of the family's internal thinking on the matter. I do not. But structurally, I think, you know, the value of the land, how well set up the family is to capitalize off of it, monetize some of the auxiliary benefits, the future of Pavco, right? And BC Place, right in that backyard, the possibility of a public-private partnership, the family's expertise in that area, both as professional sports operators, but also, you know, having land adjacent to it. I mean, there's all sorts of different considerations that would lead me to think that, you know, remaining in a prominent place of community leadership, which is, you know, one of the benefits that the team affords the family. You know, I do think that those interests most likely prove stickier than some of the looming, you know, CapEx that the club has to consider and sort of work through here, whether it's renovations on the building or a practice facility or, you know, the rising cap and the economic uncertainty, especially vis-a-vis like the value of the Canadian dollar, right? And how that might complicate things moving forward for the hockey team.
All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So we've started to see teams book their ticket into round two, a bunch of other teams with a chance to do so in the Stanley Cup playoffs tonight. And I want to relate this to the coaching environment in the NHL and, of course, the coaching vacancy here with the Vancouver Canucks as well, because I think there's an expectation that, you know, there's already eight openings, but you always want to wait to see until the first round shakes out that there could be more. You know, there could be one, both more openings on the market, but also more coaches hitting the market. We haven't seen any post round one firings yet. Do you look at certain teams in the first round or who have already been eliminated and think that coach is in trouble? I would not be surprised if a loss in round one that's either already happened or could happen would result in a coach losing their job. I think there's some that you don't worry about at all. Like Travis Green's not getting fired in Ottawa, right? After leading them back to the playoffs and taking them to game six now, his job is safe even if they lose in round one. Are there other people that you look at? Yeah, Berube. Are there other people you look at that are like maybe a little bit on the hot seat pending whatever happens in round one?
Yeah, I'm curious about Cooper simply because of the one-year extension.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Tampa Bay Lightning should, and like I thought Lalonde put it well, like I think they bumped into a buzzsaw, and I think they should be ruthless and stubborn about what they accomplished this season and sort of reaffirm their belief in their opportunity to extend this core's competitive window. I believe in that experiment just generally. I think Cooper's a huge part of it. You're certainly not landing an upgrade.
And I think also it's worth very much worth noting here. You're saying, okay, they have to be stubborn and not give in to like the easy backlash reactionary thing of firing your coach because of a third first round exit. They had probably the most difficult coaching retention decision of NHL history, right? After the record-setting season where they get swept by Columbus. And what did they do? They kept John Cooper. Like, that would have been the easiest scenario of all time to fire your coach. It wasn't like he was new at that point. That was like his fifth or sixth full season. He'd lost in the finals. They'd missed the playoffs 1 year under him, right? Like, that would have been very, very easy to say, all right, hey, good regular season coach. We're just not going to win with this guy. We're moving on. They didn't do that. So there is clearly an appetite for the type of stubbornness you're talking about and a belief. And all he's done since then is grow his reputation as a coach in the world of hockey in the NHL. As you said, you're not getting an upgrade. So I know, and people text in like, hey, John Cooper, he's from Prince George. Bring him home. Roll back up the Brinks truck. Get him to come here. I just don't – like, someone explain it to me from Tampa's perspective. Like, do you think John Cooper's a bad coach now? You know what I mean? Like, what is Tampa gaining from firing John Cooper? And I always say, look, sometimes you have a good coach and it's still the right thing to do to move on. You need a new message, all of that. I think Cooper's just in a different category, and his relationship with those players and that organization is in a different category. I haven't heard – like, I think he operates by different rules – and that organization and their coaching decisions operate by different rules than any other franchise in the NHL. If it was any other franchise, and we're talking third consecutive first-round playoff exit, I'd be like, yeah, good chance he shakes loose. I just don't see it with Cooper. And I haven't got the explanation or the theory that would make it make sense for Tampa's perspective for me.
Yeah, I think the only way that it would happen would be if there was like a conversation and a mutual decision that this is what was best for both parties. Like if Cooper was like, I want
a different challenge. I want something
new. I've taken this as far as I can take it.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, if that happens, then maybe. But, I mean, I think that team, again, should be very stubborn and protective of their accomplishments and structure and all-around setup, especially as it pertains to their head coach. Yeah. That's my personal view of the matter, and I'm sticking to it.
I feel like there's more kicks at the can there with Tampa. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there's more there.
They didn't have Brandon Hagel, like, for more than two games. He played 35 on 5 minutes in the series. He was the best left wing in hockey this year.
Yeah.
You know, like, Braden Point missed a bunch of empty nets or, like, you know, a bunch of scoring chances that were prime. When does that ever happen? Braden Point's automatic.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought the J.J. Moser and Connor Geeky additions, like, looked like they were on the verge of breaking through. It just wasn't going to happen against Tampa, especially when they were down Bjorkstrand and Hagel and Cirelli was a shell of himself. No, the Tampa Bay Lightning, if that one happens, it should be Cooper's call. That's my view.
Yep,
I strongly believe it. The Marty St. Louis not going anywhere.
Nope.
I don't think Montgomery would go anywhere if they lost. I don't think Arneal would go anywhere if they lost.
Can I throw this one at you?
Yep.
Sheldon Keith? For Rick
no
Tocchet?
They didn't have Jack Hughes.
For Rick Tocchet, though?
No, whatever. No, I don't think so. I think Sheldon Keefe did a good job. They were so far overmatched in that series. Would be one of the least fair.
Oh, I'm not saying it would be fair. I'm not saying it's merited, but if you just want to set the table, if you want to set the table for Quinn Hughes, make the change.
I mean, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Jim Hiller.
Yeah.
That one to me is interesting because if we're talking merit, I think you can make the argument that this is a series in which he cost his team.
Yep.
And I thought he did good work overall. And I think he's done some good work in this series. I mean, that power play has been lights out. I loved with 3 minutes to go, putting Kempe out as a forward even before they pulled their goalie, like going to a four-forward approach late when chasing the lead against the Oilers. I thought that was aggressive and fun and dead on. So, I mean, I think it's not as if it's been all bad, but that challenge was brutal.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they sat on the lead was brutal. The way that they've defended McDavid skating backwards as opposed to, like, hey, watch some tape from how the Canucks and Rick Tocchet game planned against McDavid last year, guys. Like, watch some tape. You got to be attacking him in layers through the neutral zone and slowing him down and, you know, have guys leaving their checks and leaving structure to slow him down. They are leaving the door open for McDavid. And McDavid's basically a vampire. You can't invite him in. And so I don't like how that series has gone. And I think that one would be a real conversation for me if I was in Kings management. I'm not even saying that I'd conclude that he needs to move on, but it would be something I'd talk about and want to talk about as a hockey operations staff. And I think that's really Bednar.
I don't like Bednar.
They go out in round one.
I don't quite get it with Bednar either. That's just it's like firing Bednar or like, look how long Sullivan lasted in Pittsburgh post them winning Stanley Cups and post them really being competitive. You know what I mean? Like once you build up that level of equity in the organization and kind of trust and reputation and weight, I think it takes more than the normal stuff to lose your job as the head coach. And I think Bednar's kind of there with Colorado as well. It would just be now look, has that front office made some aggressive moves? They sure have. But I think that would be like a very, very aggressive move to fire Jared Bednar at this stage.
I think Bednar probably stays. That like ownership group prefers stability wherever possible, except when it comes to the Denver Nuggets right before the playoffs. But, you know, I think that was a matter of guys creating drama behind the scenes and the organization getting fed up by it. So, you know, I don't think there's any indication that that's happening with the Avs. The cranky group has certainly stood by, you know, Arteta and McVay and company
now,
in challenging circumstances.
Quickly, organizations that don't necessarily prioritize stability as much. Vegas, Bruce Cassidy, if they blow this against Minnesota.
Interesting.
And really, it's mostly because of the organization predilection for doing stuff.
I don't think so. If it happens, well, here, put it this way. If any of the top candidates, like if Mike Sullivan and the Rangers really happens before
the Vegas series is concluded,
Vegas Golden Knights advances.
Right.
That tells you that the leading candidates think Cassidy is completely safe.
Right. Otherwise, they'll wait to see what shakes out with Cassidy.
That's a tell.
Yeah.
Because, you know, on the power ranking of places you want to coach, Vegas would immediately be number one with a bullet for among all these teams with vacancies. So, you know, I'm not like accusing anybody of being cynical or rooting against Cassidy or anything like that. But sometimes, you know, sometimes it's like you want to know where to find a shark, look for where there's blood in the water, right? Like sometimes there's environmental factors that actually tell you more about the situation than if you actually know about the situation. So I feel like that will be a tell. If Sullivan, for example, tomorrow is going to New York, then I think that tells you that the top guys think Cassidy's safe.
That is Canucks Talk for today. As a reminder, we're off tomorrow. Josh and Lena have a two-hour edition of Canucks Brunch at 11. That leads into a nooner at the Nat for the Vancouver Canadiens. Drantz, safe travels tomorrow, buddy, and we will reconnect
Thanks,
on
man.
Monday. Have a great weekend, everyone. We're back on Monday here on Sportsnet 650.